Welcome to my Soul Series. Soul Series is part of Oprah and Friends, exclusively on XM Radio Channel 156. And you can listen to the entire Soul Series collection on xmradio.com/Oprah. My guest today says that there is a seismic shift going on in much of the world. And although you may not have felt it, you will. Your children definitely will. Author Daniel Pink claims that gone are the days where left-brain thinkers, doctors, lawyers, computer programmers, accountants, excel without incorporating design, story, symphony, empathy, play, and meaning into their work. I read his book, it's called A Whole New Mind, and I think he's really onto something here. Is spirituality and right-brain creativity as important as intellect? Well, I gave it to each member of the graduating class of Stanford, a copy of this book I did when I spoke there earlier this year, and I'm excited today to introduce Dan Pink's ideas to you. I think this conversation will complement what we've been discussing with Eckhart Tolle on A New Earth, because how better to recognize that than by cultivating a whole new mind? Daniel Pink, coming up. It's uplifting, enlightening, truly powerful. Welcome to Soul Series. The last few decades have belonged to a certain kind of person with a certain kind of mind. Computer programmers who could crank code, lawyers who could craft contracts, MBAs who could crunch numbers. But the keys to the kingdom are changing hands. I'm Oprah, and this is my Soul Series, and these are the prophetic words from a book I picked up last spring, and I literally could not put the book down. I liked it so much. Y'all know what happens when I like a book. I thought it such an important piece of work that I proceeded to purchase 4,500 copies and give 4,500 copies as gifts to the graduating class at Stanford, where I was the commencement speaker. I also purchased copies for all of the upper management here at Harpo, because I now believe that A Whole New Mind, this book I'm holding in my hand, A Whole New Mind, Why Right-Brainers Will Rule the Future, is an imperative for future success. Daniel Pink, I just want you to know, I was definitely in my right mind when I picked up this book.
Wow, thank you. Thank you. And thanks for giving it out to everyone at Stanford.
Welcome. See, I didn't even call you to tell you I was going to do it.
Well, when my publisher told me this was happening, I actually asked to call them back to make sure that it wasn't a friend of mine pulling a prank on me. Oprah just bought 4,000 copies for everyone at Stanford. And I said, all right, is this Stengel? Is this Mark? Who is this pulling my leg here?
Well, this is what's so great about it. I got the, it was actually 4,500 copies, and I got the 4,500 copies. The 4,500 copies arrived at Harpo, and I was thinking, and I was also giving the book A New Earth. Uh-huh. So what is so fascinating about it, both of them were in the same color tones. Both
sure.
were orange.
Uh-huh.
Okay. So then I thought, okay, how am I going to present it? Okay, I'd like to have ribbons. So then it became, okay, who is going to tie 4,500 ribbons? It sounded like a good idea when I had it. And then, really. So I ended up having a team of 10 people who tied 4,500 ribbons.
Wow.
I had ordered the ribbons. First of all, order the ribbons in the same cup. But anyway, it turned into a thing. I'm glad to be able to sit down and talk to you.
It's a pleasure for me.
Really? Well, explain to us, since I've given this book to everybody, I could really do my own interview about it. But since you're here, I'll let you talk. Explain to us, number one, difference between left brain and right brain. Why right-brainers are going to rule the future? What is my right brain?
Okay. Our brains, I'm using the two sides of our brains as a metaphor mm-hmm. for understanding how the world works, really how business works and how the world of careers works.
Right.
And I think that metaphor gives us an idea of what it's going to take to succeed. It mm-hmm. used to be that the abilities that mattered most in any kind of profession were the left brain kind of abilities, logical, linear, sequential, SAT, spreadsheet kind of abilities.
Right.
And today, those abilities still matter,
right.
but they're not enough. And the abilities that now matter most are abilities that are characteristic of the right hemisphere. Artistry, empathy, inventiveness, big picture thinking. Those kinds of abilities have become really the first among equals in a whole range of businesses, a whole range of professions.
And so does it mean that those people who are more left-brained, more logical, you know, accountants, lawyers, so forth, that those people are going to be out of work?
Not necessarily.
Yeah.
But it means that they have some work to do. People like me. I myself happen to be an extremely left-brained person. Very logical, very linear.
Really? I did not get that impression from reading this book.
Well, then I did a good job of concealing my inner self. But I'm trying to myself to try to learn how to do these things, to do
really?
These things better. My instinct is always to draw a chart rather than to draw a picture.
Really?
Yeah. Here's the thing. What's interesting is that this is not necessarily how I want the world to be. I actually think the world is ultimately better. I think that this shift toward right-brain abilities has the potential to make us both better off and better in a deeper sense. But for me, it's a challenge. I have to get better at a lot of these right-brain abilities. I did very good at the left-brain stuff, and now I'm trying to work these right-brain muscles into shape.
Well, this is why I was so attracted to the book. First of all, I had read Jill Bolte Taylor's book, My Stroke of Insight,
right,
where she talks about having the stroke in the left hemisphere of the brain and then being aware the whole time and being able to speak of that. And Jill Bolte Taylor has been on this show also. And so all of that talk about the right brain in her book made me notice your book, which was, you know, already on the bestsellers list, Why Right Brainers Will Rule the Future. And I read this book, and I was so excited for myself because I thought, this is my time, because I am what I need to be is more left brain, but I live in the right brain.
Mm-hmm.
I live in that hemisphere.
Well, that's how a lot of people have responded, that the world is coming around to them. And a lot of times, especially in this country, these right brain abilities, we haven't taken seriously enough. They said the people who are smart are the people who have these logical linear abilities.
That's right.
And these other people, they're flighty, they're spacey, they're artsy-fartsy.
Woo-woo, yeah.
Woo-woo, not serious. And actually, the world, in a very hard-headed way, I mean, I came to this conclusion with the left side of my brain by just looking at the facts and looking at the evidence. And
yeah, so these are not woo-woo conclusions.
Not at all. I'm not that much of a woo-woo guy. I mean, I'm trying to sort of get more woo-woo, I guess, in order to navigate this world. But I think if you look at the facts, it's very clear that the scales are tilting, that the sorts of abilities of people, I'm in my mid-40s, the sorts of abilities, let's say parents of people in my generation said, you know, learn how to become an accountant, learn how to become a lawyer. Those are the abilities that will give you a very solid foothold in the middle class. Those kinds of abilities now still matter, but they're the kinds of abilities you can send overseas. They're the kinds of abilities you can reduce to lines of code in a computer program or website. And they're the kinds of things in this world where we have so much stuff, just so much material abundance, that what you really need is the ability to iterate something new, to come up with something the world didn't know it was missing. And those end up being very right-brain abilities.
Okay. Would you say that you've become more woo-woo based or right-brain based on what you've learned writing this book?
In some ways, if you look, I mean, you know, in the book, as you know, we talk about six particular abilities.
Yes.
And some of them I'm pretty good at. Some of them I need some work on.
Mm-hmm.
One of the abilities is symphony, which is big picture thinking. I'm reasonably good at that.
Yeah.
Meaning is another one. I'm reasonably good at that.
Yeah.
The other ones, empathy, design, those kinds of things, I actually am trying to work those muscles back into shape.
Yeah. I'm really good at empathy and meaning story.
Story, of course.
Really good at that. Not really good at play. I got to get better at play.
Yeah, me too.
So I'm going to talk about the six senses. But first, you in the beginning of the book talk about how we've come through all the various ages, and now we're in the conceptual age.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, we came through the agricultural age, the industrial age, the technological age, and I would think that most people would think that with the advancements, the rapid, you know, exponentially advancing technology, that we're still in the technological age. But you say we're in a different age, the conceptual age.
Right.
How did you conclude that?
Well, I mean, if you think about what makes the economies go round and who makes the economies go round, we had a world of agriculture where most people in this country were growing food.
Right.
Well, then what happened? We got better at growing food. Technology improved. We could import food from other places. As people got wealthier, they needed new things.
Right.
Boom. We start doing something else. We start becoming an industrial
economy age,
where you have the factory worker at the center of it.
Right.
Then what happens? Technology improves. We import manufactured goods elsewhere. We get richer. Boom.
Boom.
Pushes us to the information age. it's the same thing happening over and over again. It's the same thing happening one more time. What we now have is that the knowledge worker, the sort of the SAT worker, the spreadsheet person, is seeing his or her abilities be able to get done cheaper overseas,
yeah,
faster by a computer, and also be somewhat inadequate when you have there's just such a level of material well-being in this country. I mean, you have 98% of homes have a color TV. 88% of homes have mobile phones.
I'm going to page 28 where you talk about abundance,
yeah,
Asia, and automation.
The three A's.
Okay, the three A's. Let's talk about abundance and how that has affected us in the conceptual age.
Well, abundance is actually, I think, one of the most significant things going on in this country, and it often gets the least amount of attention, because what gets our attention is bad news that happens fast. And our brains are constructed in that way.
Absolutely.
Our media is constructed to find.
And now everybody is, we are bombarded with information about the recession. So whether you were feeling it or not, no matter who you are, you're now feeling it, because every night we're told we're feeling it. Yes.
Right.
Okay.
But in some ways, the recession is like having a head cold. Okay, you have a head cold. We have a head cold, and having a head cold is a pain, and it's going to last a little bit of time, and then it's going to go away.
Right.
But the long trend is like a pretty darn healthy body.
Right.
If you look at it in material terms.
In material terms.
We got more automobiles than we have licensed drivers. My grandparents, middle-class people, didn't have a car. My two grandmothers, middle-class women, never learned how to drive.
Wow.
Now, but think about a middle-class woman today not learning how to drive.
Yeah.
Because a car was a luxury.
Uh-huh.
I mean, my kids find this surprising. And I say, well, your dad doesn't know how to pilot a yacht. It doesn't come up all that often.
That's right.
So, it's not high on the list of skills I need to master.
That's right.
So we have more automobiles than we have licensed drivers. We have a self-storage industry. Okay, an industry devoted to excess stuff.
Oh, interesting. You mentioned that in the book. I'm talking to Daniel Pink, author of A Whole New Mind, by the way, one of my favorite books this year that I love so much, gave out to the entire graduating class at Stanford. Okay, continuing about abundance.
So abundance changes the game in a very hard-headed business way. Go ahead.
In the book, okay, because I know the book too. But I love the story that you tell in the book where you and your wife and kids, you're out shopping.
Yep.
Tell us that story.
Which
illustrates the abundance principle.
Yeah, I mean, we go to a shopping mall in Northern Virginia. We live in Washington, D.C., and I just, for back to school, and I think about times of my going to Eastland Mall in Columbus, Ohio in the early 1970s.
That's right.
Climate controlled. Ooh, it's always a comfortable 72 degrees. I mean, that was like the big selling point
for me, there wasn't even a mall. It was Sears.
There was a Sears was one of the anchors of Eastland Mall. Absolutely.
Okay.
And so Penny's was the other anchor.
Yep.
And, and so here you go into Target, where you have, like, designer goods everywhere for reasonable prices. You go next door, it is a giant big box pet store where you have, probably larger than the entire Eastland Mall for stuff for our animals.
I know.
You have
the things you can get for your animals are astounding.
The electronics, where you walk in there and you're just overwhelmed by this, wall of sound and light of these kinds of electronics that each one, if you think about it, it's quite remarkable. If you think about just a mobile phone or even a DVD player, a mobile phone has more computing power in it than existed when my grandparents were my age.
Absolutely.
And so it changes the game of how you navigate. It's great for customers. It's great for consumers.
Okay.
It's a glorious thing.
And so one of the things that struck me, because I hadn't even thought about this, amazing abundance that we all have, no matter who you are, whatever your income level is, just like you were saying, everybody has a color television set.
Mm-hmm.
All right. And how the effect of that abundance impacts the way we see our things, so that you no longer just want to have things, you want to have cool things. You want to have well-designed things. You want to have interesting things. You want to have things with meaning. You want to have things, yeah.
Absolutely. And think about it from the perspective of the people who are creating.
Yes.
Well, I mean, if you're in business,
yes.
All right, your job in a world of abundance is to give people something they didn't know they were missing. That's the iPod.
That's right.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
Tens of millions of people have iPods. 8 years ago, they didn't know they were missing an iPod.
No. Not only tens of millions of people haven't. I mean, I was in Chicago, and I remember trying to get home that evening, and people are standing around the corner at the Apple store waiting for the first one.
Because it's something they didn't know they were missing. And so that ability – but that's a very creative – it's an artistic ability. What do artists do? Artists give people something they didn't know they were missing. A dance, a piece of music, a painting, a piece of sculpture.
It's all not... right brain.
It's all right brain, and it's the best business strategy. And then, I mean, it's very hard.
But an iPod is both left brain. In order for it to come into existence, has to be a lot of left brain activity going into creating an iPod. But the idea of the iPod is very right brain.
There are plenty of other portable MP3 players that we're not talking about right here.
Correct.
Because it has certain elements. It's easy to use. It's beautifully designed. It's an object of desire.
Yes.
And that is the best business strategy.
You can appealing to all the six senses that you were talking about.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. Okay. So all of this abundance has created a desire to have things that are of more meaning and have contained the elements of the six senses that you refer to in A Whole New Mind. And then there is automation.
Automation. Last century, you had machines replace our back, our muscle.
Yes.
Machines can do physical tasks better than we can.
Right.
Now you have software doing the same thing to our brains.
Yes.
But right now, at least, the only kind of intellectual processing the software can replace is the left side, the logical, linear, sequential, rule-based side.
I'm listening to you. I'm just looking
for
that picture.
So John Henry, right?
Yes.
So you see, in what we have in this country, we had, you know, each year about 1 million U.S. tax returns are done in India.
Yes.
And people go wiggy over that. Oh, no way an American accountant can compete with an Indian accountant who's making $500 a month. Meanwhile, you have over 20 million people who do their income taxes using software, because a $29 piece of software can do your income taxes just as well as a human being.
Well, I love it. On page 36 of A Whole New Mind, you have the picture, and there are four Indian people sitting at a table, and you say, here are four people I met while researching this book. They are the very embodiment of the knowledge worker ethic I described at the outset of this chapter. Like many bright middle-class kids, they followed their parents' advice, they did well in high school, went on to earn either an engineering or computer science degree from a good university, and now work at a large software company helping to write computer code for North American banks and airlines. For their high-tech work, none of these four people earns more than about $15,000 a year. And $15,000 a year in India puts them...
upper middle class.
In upper middle class. And these people are taking jobs that once belonged to people making $70,000 a year here, is what you're saying.
Right. They have the capacity to do that. The kind of work they're doing, you get paid here in Chicago $70,000 a year for.
And so that's why it's abundance, automation, and Asia.
And Asia, right.
Yes.
And so essentially with Asia, what's happening is, if you just think of the numbers, there are, you know, tens of millions of people who can do these kinds of routine tasks. That is, and here's the word. I mean, here's the word that, for those of us who have people who have kids, the scariest word in the economy right now is the word routine. Anything that is routine is disappearing from this country. And routine is work you can reduce to a spec sheet, to a script, to a formula, to a series of steps that has a right answer. If you can write down the steps and it has a right answer, someone can take that work, send the script or the spec sheet overseas, and have someone overseas give you the right answer for a lot less. And the scary part is that...
I could have had those bows tied for a lot less. Yes, and the scary part is...
The scary part is that routine work... Well, I mean, it's a good example. I mean, actually, that kind of work is protected a little bit because you have to be physically there to do it.
Mm-hmm.
But if there were the kind of the digital equivalent of ribbon tying, no way. That would have been... Because tying a ribbon is following a set of rules.
Right.
Do this, do this, do this. You know whether it's right. And there
right.
you have it. And the thing is, certain kinds of work that middle-class moms and dads in this country told their kids to do is routine.
Like?
Certain kinds of accounting is routine.
Absolutely.
Certain kinds of, I mean, I went to law school, for God's sake. Certain kinds of law is routine. Certain kinds of financial analysis is routine. And so in order to make it today, you have to do work that's hard to outsource, hard to automate, and that delivers on these new imperatives of this very abundant age.
So what advice do you give to kids who are in school? I mean, I gave this book to the guys at Stanford and women of Stanford. And I'm saying, I wonder how many of those kids are really actually going to read the book. Probably none of them this week. But when you talk to colleges or speak to kids who are looking for what to do with their lives now, what's your best advice?
Well, my advice... at one level, it's very hard to predict exactly what I would never say to someone who's 22 years old, go, you know, plastics or go into
yes.
some kind of field, because who knows
right.
what's going to happen.
That's I say follow your passion. But anyway.
Well, I agree with that. I say do something that's hard to outsource and hard to automate. But then ultimately, it's really about following your intrinsic motivation, doing it is sort of figuring out your purpose. What are you here to do? What are you uniquely good at? And then I would actually add to that the importance of doing it persistently, being dogged. I think that there are massive returns to doggedness.
Do you believe that paradox of prosperity is the reason why that we're now seemingly seeking and meaning and more than ever?
I think that's part of it. Mm-hmm. I mean, what you have is you have us, all this abundance has liberated us, but not fulfilled us. And so you have people liberated by prosperity, but not fulfilled by it. So they're using their extra time and energy and treasure to lift that level of satisfaction. But the yearning to understand what it's all about is a human yearning. I mean, when we were on the savannah evolving, we were saying, wow, what am I doing here? What's the purpose here? How did I get here? But, you know, then a saber-toothed tiger comes running in and you scurry away from it. You know, you don't have the luxury of spending that much time thinking about it. But now people have, you know, this prosperity ultimately isn't ultimately fulfilling to people. And so the prosperity has in some ways liberated this thing that's, I think, fundamental about being a human being, which is figuring out, What am I here for?
Why am I here?
What's it all about? How am I connected to everything else?
Okay. So do you personally believe in divinity?
Depends on what you mean by divinity. I believe that life has a purpose. Mm-hmm. I believe that we're here for a purpose. As I said, of the six abilities, I'm pretty good at meaning. I mean, I think that what gives people satisfaction is doing something that's about a cause larger than themselves,
yes.
About doing something that leaves some kind of an imprint. And to some extent, in the books that I write, that's what I'm trying to do in a modest way. Now, I know that it works, and some of those Stanford students have read the book because I've gotten emails from them.
Oh, have you?
Yeah. And so that's, you know.
What do they say? Tell me.
Can I sell this on eBay? No. They said, this is a great book. I hadn't heard of it. And, you know, I have some time and I started reading it. And this really made me think about what I'm here for. Now, what's interesting is that from the students, both at Stanford and elsewhere, a lot of them say, I'm going to give this book to my parents because they're good at, say, like, I'm an art history major and art history is my passion.
Yes.
But my mom thinks I should go get an MBA and become an accountant. I'm going to give this book to her. I've gotten that from some Stanford grads and I've gotten that from a lot of other young people.
Well, one of the things you say that the MFA is the new MBA.
Right.
Tell us what you mean.
Well, an MFA is Master of Fine Art and the MBA is, you know, business degree. Certain kinds of business things, abilities, you can send overseas and you can reduce to software. And so you have investment banks and whatnot sending their back office jobs overseas. Now they're sending their middle office jobs overseas. Whereas what do fine artists do? They iterate something new, unexpected, delightful, that changes the world. And so those MFA abilities are actually harder to outsource and harder to automate and more important in an abundant world. So, you know, I've said that the MFA is the new MBA, which has ensured that I never get invited to a business school.
Do you believe that we all have souls?
Sure. I think.
And does the soul live in the right brain?
Well, actually, I think you can make a. I can answer with my left brain.
Okay.
I mean, I think that there's scientific evidence that shows that.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I think in some ways, Jill Bolte Taylor's narrative is about that. And there are locations in the right hemisphere of the brain.
Well, she was definitely, you know, tripping out in the soul part of herself, and their left brain was all shot. So she was definitely hanging out there.
And there are experiments out there where they do certain kinds of, they sort of quiet this part to allow people to experience ecstatic experiences or holistic experience or divine experience. I think that that is part of what it is to be human. It's just now I think what's interesting is that instead of it being seen as woo-woo, as we were talking about before, it's taken seriously because there's scientific evidence. So the left-brainers have to respect that.
Yeah.
And it also ends up being valuable in business. You have all these young people out there today, these Stanford graduates, saying, I want a job with meaning. I want a job that's about something larger than myself. I want a job that allows me to do something that matters.
So does that mean if you, you know, really are just sort of formulaic, left brain centered, that you are less spiritual?
Not necessarily. I mean, again, all these things are fundamentally human abilities. These right brain abilities are fundamentally human abilities. Some of us have exercised these muscles repeatedly over our lives, often to the derision of others.
Mm-hmm.
Others of us have kept them quieter, muscles that we haven't used, but they're all things that matter to people. I think that this idea of spirituality, of the divine, of wondering what it's all about, is encoded into our DNA. It's in our brains. It's part of what it is to be human. Other animals don't wonder about that. I don't think that a mouse is running around the hallway saying, not these hallways, by the way, but running around the hallway saying, what am I here for? What's my purpose? How do I live my best mouse life?
Well, no. Well, my best mouse life, I like that. But I think what we have talked about before in this whole series is that what the mouse and the dog and the elephant and the horse and all that, what they are is just in the moment. They are not worried about or thinking about whatever. They just, I'm a mouse and that's it.
Well, that's an interesting point, too. A very interesting point, because in some ways the left hemisphere, if you think about it, again, I don't want to geek out on you here, but okay. If you think about it in terms of, like, verb tenses,
okay,
the left hemisphere is basically past and future, and right hemisphere is present.
Now. Uh-huh.
And so that's what, I mean, so
that's not geeking out on me.
Right.
That's just what we talk about here.
All right.
Come
no,
on.
No, I was thinking the whole thing about verb tenses.
No,
here,
okay,
you know?
Good. No, okay. No, that's not geeking out at all.
Yeah. And so I think that's a big part of what it is. The thing is, I think the heartening thing for all of us is that it's being taken seriously. There are scientists out there who are looking at this. You have the Dalai Lama doing joint projects with neuroscientists. You have the Jill Bolte Taylors of the world who have, you know, incredible street cred on neuroscience and neuroanatomy, talking about her own experience and saying, this is what I learned from it. And then you also have the recognition that, you know, in a world of abundance, it's just not enough. And I think it's true in terms of how companies recruit. I think it's true in terms of how people navigate their lives. And I think we haven't, in many ways, seen anything yet on this kind of widespread search for meaning because of the baby boomers.
And don't you think that, first of all, the saying that white right-brainers are going to rule the future, that learning to tap into those six senses would be more helpful to all of us in being more, you know, right-brain-centered?
Absolutely.
Design. So let's talk about design.
Yeah. Well, design is the ability to create something that has both usefulness and meaning and significance. And so I think that design today has become a fundamental business literacy. I mean, if you think about how CEOs, see, I like to look for evidence of these things in the least likely places. So not go to art schools, but let's look at CEOs. The chairman, president, and CEO of Procter & Gamble. What does Procter & Gamble make? Soap.
Yeah.
Toothpaste.
Yeah.
He says, these are his words, it's all design at Procter & Gamble. It's all that would have gotten him fired 15 years ago. Now it's part of what it means to be a CEO because he's recognizing that
design is so important. I mean, I remember we had when we were talking about, green products and so forth. And there is a company called Shackley that does.
Sure.
These They have the best. The reason why, I mean, I think the products are good, but what I realized after reading this book, the reason why I really love the products is because they make me feel clean because of the design of the bottles and the design of the products is so fantastic. It's design.
Absolutely.
So Mr. Procter and Mr. Gamble, it's all about design.
But in a whole range of things, it's all design when it comes to, you know, somebody's in healthcare. Hospitals are bringing in designers.
Yeah.
What's the design experience of the waiting room in a hospital? You have a young designer in New York who redesigned the prescription bottle, and because she noticed her grandparents were getting confused about what medicines to take. She looked at the prescription bottle and she said, this doesn't make any sense from a design perspective. I mean, the thing in biggest type is the doctor's name. It's least, you know, important,
yeah, right,
piece of information. Her grandparents are getting confused. She redesigns a prescription bottle so that the name of the medicine is on top, the dosage is right underneath, the other information is in smaller type below it.
Yes.
Grandpa gets a green band on his medicine. Grandma gets a yellow band on her medicine so they don't get confused. And so here's how design thinking can literally save lives.
All right. Story.
Story. We live in a world where facts are everywhere. And so what matters finding a fact doesn't really matter that much. If you and I wanted to know the gross domestic product of Ecuador, we could find it out in, my kids could find it out in 15 seconds. So what matters less than facts is the ability to put facts in context and deliver them with emotional impact. And that's what a story does. But again, that's also fundamentally human. We have in our head something called a story grammar. We see the world as a series of episodes, not as a series of logical propositions. Even people like me see the world as a series of episodes.
Even you, you left-brainer. Okay, so we're going to continue this conversation next week, because obviously 30 minutes is not enough time. It never is. We should just change this to an hour, but you know, that's another story. So we're going to come back next week and talk about how we can cultivate a lot of those right brain attributes, and we can rule the future. Daniel Pink, A Whole New Mind. I hope you enjoyed this edition of our Soul Series. These are some of my favorite conversations.
To hear more, sign up for a free 30-day XM Radio trial by going to www.xmradio.com/Oprah.